Episode 255, author and high school teacher, Terry Bartley.
A mistake is like something that you sort of like did, you look back on it and you're like, gee, I wish I hadn't have done that, you know?
I'm Mark Graben. This is My Favorite Mistake. In this podcast, you'll hear business leaders and other really interesting people talking about their favorite mistakes. Because we all make mistakes, but what matters is learning from our mistakes instead of repeating them over and over again. So this is the place for honest reflection and conversation, personal growth, and professional success. Visit our website at myfavoritemistakepodcast.com. To learn more about Terry, his books, his podcast, and more, look for links in the show notes or go to markgraben.com/mistake255. As always, thanks for taking time to listen. And now, on with the show. Well, hi, welcome back to My Favorite Mistake. I'm Mark Graben. My guest today is Terry Bartley. He's a high school journalism, literature, and English teacher, and he's an author of a new collection of short stories available now called Tyranny of the Fae. Terry is also host of the podcast Most Writers Are Fans, about the intersection between writing and fandom. He's professionally written for publications including the Coal Valley News and Screen Rant. He's won awards for writing and broadcasting from the West Virginia Associated Press, the National Broadcasting Society, and MarCom. He has a BA in English from the University of Phoenix and an MA in English Education from Western Governors University. So Terry, welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thanks so much for having me. I'm great. You know, it's funny, you write those, like I wrote that myself, right? Like that intro I wrote years ago, like whenever I started this writing journey, whenever you hear somebody read it out loud to you, it's always like, oh, wow, I've actually done a good bit. It's always a fun
surprise.
Well,
I hope that's a good boost to get started here as we record this during, I'm sure, a well-deserved and you know, a Thanksgiving break from teaching, right?
Yeah. Teaching is one of those things that's like overwhelming. So whenever you have like the week off, it honestly doesn't even feel like enough of a break. It's just time to like think for yourself for like the first time for a while.
A little free time. And thank you for spending some of that with us and with me here on the podcast. So, you know, I'm curious of where the story is going to come from, different dimensions of your professional life. But Terry, as we ask everybody here, what would you say is your favorite mistake?
Yeah, so it's interesting to think about the idea of like my favorite mistake, because I feel like whenever I think about the term mistake, like that doesn't mean like something that I had no control over that I did by accident. You know what I'm saying? Like a mistake is like something that you sort of like did, that you look back on and you're like, gee, I wish I hadn't have done that. You know? So we talked a lot about ADHD because I was diagnosed later in life with ADHD, and like I don't regret that I didn't get diagnosed earlier, that kind of thing, because like I didn't know I had to. You know what I mean? like that's not a mistake for me. What I think is a mistake, and it stems from not getting diagnosed earlier, is the fact that I jumped around job to job to job to job. Like I didn't have any consistent career for a long time because I kept sort of like chasing the shiny thing, which I didn't realize was ADHD, right? And that's the thing that I look back on, and like I'm so grateful that I've had so many experiences and such a wide breadth of experiences. I think that makes me a stronger writer. I think that I understand a lot of different specific things about the world that I wouldn't have otherwise. But gee, I wish I would have found a career that I could have stuck with for more than 3 years at a time.
So how long have you stuck with teaching now? Like I'd like to go back. I mean, you know, maybe tell us about some of those different jobs or careers, but you're sticking with teaching and everything you're doing now?
I mean, I don't know that that's true, but so far, so good. Because here's the thing about how I got into teaching, which I think is a very ADHD story. So I was working in a nonprofit as a freelancer. So I was like working sort of like, you know, not enough money, but like doing it because I loved the work. And I was like, we were like doing community building things, like helping people reinvigorate the economy. I live in Southern West Virginia, like coal country. So like it was the idea of getting communities to empower themselves and figure out ways to like rebuild their economy themselves. So it was like really fulfilling work. I really loved it, but it paid like next to nothing. So I had to do something to supplement the income. So I started substitute teaching because I had a bachelor's in English that I had sort of gotten again, just kind of because I wanted to, not because like it helped me towards any career. I just wanted to be a writer, and I was like, this seems like the thing to do. So then the superintendent at the time wanted people that were subbing to at least be like pursuing certification in teaching. So I was like, all right, well, I could either go get a certification certificate for like a year, or I could spend 2 years getting a master's degree. And then if I eventually start teaching, then I get paid more with a degree. And also, I have a master's degree. I could use that for other jobs, right? Like, it opens up other doors down the road. So I started pursuing this master's in English education just so that I could sub. That's truly why I did it, just so that I could have extra money while I was working this nonprofit job. A nonprofit job ended because that's how they worked. The grant ended. There wasn't funding anymore, whatever, whatever. Started subbing full-time just because it made the most sense at the time to just kind of, like, lean into that. Then the pandemic happened, and then I, like, wasn't working at all because, you know, if there's no school to go to, you can't substitute teach. And subs don't get paid if they are not there working. So I got paid nothing for the pandemic. But I was just continuing the degree because it's like, well, I may as well keep doing this thing that I'm doing, right? By the time the pandemic ended, well, truly it's not even ended, right? But by the time quarantine ended to some extent, I started subbing again. I got a long-term sub job because there was an older teacher that couldn't come back. She didn't want to come back because there was a pandemic happening. So I got a long-term sub job. And towards the, as she came back was whenever my student teaching started. So then I worked as a student teacher just to finish up the degree. And then it was like, well, I guess I should be a teacher now that I have a master's degree in English education. So like, I didn't even like, so to say like, is teaching the thing I'm sticking with? I truly don't know because I didn't actually choose to become a teacher. I just kind of like stumbled into it because it was like what I was doing.
And it's something you could do. I mean, with your background and the,
right, and
I'm sure alignment with some interest. I know teaching is tough. I hope all in all, you're enjoying it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so it's interesting because it's hard and it's a thing that as a writer, because whenever you're an independent author, you're doing like three jobs at once, right? Like I have to promote my writings through social media and interviews like this, things like that. I do book signings, which is also a whole other thing. But then also I have to actually write, which is like a whole second job to the writing thing, right? And then teaching is like another full-time job, which if you ask any teachers, like two full-time jobs also. So it's kind of like I work four full-time jobs. And I often think like this would be easier were I not a teacher because I could have a job that wasn't quite so demanding that I did on the side. But then teaching does pay me enough that I don't feel like I'm throwing so much money away at writing because I think I would if I was getting paid a lot less. So, and I live in West Virginia, but I know the teachers don't get paid a ton, but it's one of the better paying jobs here. So I think that's something that I do like about it is like, it's a job that is consistent that I can just keep working and I know the income I'm going to get. Because when you did freelance, I did freelance work for so long. I did done like part-time freelance stuff. And I know the teachers don't get paid enough, but whenever you get paid the same amount every 2 weeks, it's like, wow, this is like, I'm like rich now.
Consistent. So it sounds like you define yourself, Terry, as a writer who teaches as opposed to a teacher who also writes. That's kind of your... You frame yourself and think of yourself as a writer. And if you could do that full time, you would, but it's tough, I'm sure.
Yeah. And I feel like that's the thing that makes me feel unusual as a teacher, because most teachers like it's their passion, right? Like they get into it because like they love the idea of like helping craft the new generation and like being there for the kids and things like that. And like, I'm fine with that stuff, right? Like I enjoy that part of it, but it's not my passion. Like my passion is kind of like telling stories and creating and truly my passion is kind of like trying to like build a better world, which I guess teaching can be like a part of. But I like the idea of trying to release books that can make people think differently and maybe like shape the way that the world is around that.
It seems like there's that opportunity to try to influence or shape or support kids. I don't know how many of them love writing or even say, Mr. Bartley, I want to be a writer. I mean, are there many cases where that you can have that direct influence?
I've definitely had a few of those. And I will say, I think that just having a thing that's not teaching is interesting. And I like to think inspiring for students because, you know, whenever you live in a place like this where people don't tend to like reach outside of, and honest, this is an aside, but ADHD, right? before I went on a tour this past summer to promote the book, I drove across the country. before that, I went to a post office where I mailed out bookmarks to like every bookstore in the state, just to kind of like promotional bookmarks to get people in the state to like support me, hopefully. I mailed them out and the post office worker was asking me like what it is. We talked about it. And she was like, you know, I really appreciate seeing somebody doing this because most people in this area don't like strive for more or like want more than what they have and take these kinds of like, chances. And I don't think that that's actually a thing that's specific to this area. I think that it's just like most people don't reach for more. I think that most people, and I don't even think that it's a bad thing. I think that a lot of people are like happy and satisfied with like normal lives. And I'm just not that, you know, and I don't think that, so I don't think that that makes me better. I just think that it makes me very different. And I think that when you grow up in this environment, and there probably are kids that are similar to me in that way, that want things that are different or want what people think of as more, I think that they probably do appreciate seeing somebody that's doing that, yeah. You know?
So, I mean, I appreciate how you point to the mistakes of changing jobs so many times as something that led to, you know, a positive. I appreciate that you can see, you know, what that has led to and how that shaped you. But, you know, I was wondering, Terry, for people who don't understand, you know, the ADHD mind and the shiny object thing. Like people think of ADHD as like, well, you know, you have trouble paying attention or, you know, you're fidgety, but there's kind of more to it. If you could explain from what you've learned and what you've lived.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I sort of like the first light bulb moment for me, I was part of this organization called the JCs. It's this like leadership organization for people up to 40 years old. It was a big, big part of my life for a very long time. I was part of this fellowship committee where it was like the 12 like top people, like up and coming people, like to the being, you know, nurtured to be upcoming leaders. And we were doing a training with this public speaker person who came in to teach us about public speaking. And part of the training was she wanted us to like write down our milestones in our life, like our big, big milestones. And then she had us partner up with somebody and then we would like share them with each other. And so I shared my list, which was like 12, 15 things. and the other person shared their list, which was like 2 things. And we went around the room with everybody and everybody else had like 2 things. And I was like, hold up, this feels unusual that I've had like over 10 moments that have like changed me and defined me as a person. And nobody else has had nearly that many.
Interesting. But then there's that. As I shared with Terry before, I'll share a little bit here with the audience. I've done some research or education about ADHD because I received a later in life diagnosis 1.5 years ago. And as the world turns, I mean, I should just do a solo episode about this sometime. A psychologist this year in 2023 thinks I was misdiagnosed with ADHD. I went through this, you know, kind of education effort and recognizing, you know, the certain, you know, generalized impulsiveness that seems to come with ADHD that can be described, you know, that behavior as, you know, executive function, quote unquote, pardon the finger quotes. And it could be caused by ADHD. It could be caused by other things, but I think there's just that general, it seems like it's often described as a lack of impulse control of like, you're supposed to be paying attention to something, but your mind goes to something else and you find that hard to control. Fair to say?
Yeah. So I think when it comes to symptoms of ADHD, there's sort of like two big buckets that I think of. One bucket is like, I feel like it's like a general lack of direction. I never felt this, for the record. Whenever I was undiagnosed, I never felt this. I always felt like I was like chasing something that was always like on the horizon. I don't know how many jobs I've described as I felt like my life was leading me to this. Like I've said that about like 5 or 6 different jobs. And I'm like, and this feels like the thing I'm meant to do in this world. And I've said that about 5 or 6 different jobs. And you can't, there's not, that doesn't exist. You can't be meant to do 5 or 6 different things in this world. But like, I think that general lack of direction is just like, I don't see the actual like threads. You know what I mean? Like I'm just like chasing different things and everywhere I've gone, I've like built different skill sets. And oftentimes the skill sets I've built have helped me in these different professions, but it is almost like secondary or irrelevant like there were career paths for everything that I jumped into, but I would rather like jump into some brand new thing instead of like pursuing that career path. And that's the thing that I think is like that lack of direction is like, you're not sort of like seeing the like actual logical way to benefit yourself professionally, which is to say like to stick with a job and like get promotions and like get paid more and do all those things, like establish a resume that makes sense. Whenever I write my resume right now, it's like, all right, so you did these five separate things that are unrelated fully. Why do you think this qualifies you for this position? Then I have to like justify it. And usually I can, because I can talk my way around it, but it's like a stretch. You know? Like it doesn't make any logical sense as to why. And I think that that's like the big overall arching thing that I've seen in my life. Then I think the other symptoms for ADHD are like a lot of these like little things where you feel like you're like not a good person. I don't mean like not a nice or like not a like good as in like a pure person, but like you're just not good at being a person.
Right.
Does that make sense? Like you can't pay your bills on time and you can't like I got pulled over at a police checkpoint the other day because my inspection sticker on my car was expired literally 2 years ago. And my license plate had expired maybe like three months ago. And whenever I explained to the cop like why it wasn't, I was like, literally, I never know that the inspection sticker is expired until the cop tells me it is. They told me over. Because I just don't pay attention to it. It's just not a thing that I think to like look for or even like keep in mind.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that I think is like the ongoing challenge with ADHD. And it makes you feel like you're like not good enough just to like live life. Like not even for your job, but just like to live life. Like you're not doing the things that everyone says you're just supposed to like naturally do. Those are the things that are like hard.
And I mean, what's fascinating to me from all of that is how symptoms or things resonate with me because, you know, the counselor who had first said, okay, you have ADHD, described it as a mild to medium case. I don't have all of the symptoms or behavioral outputs. I get my bills paid. I mean, auto pay helps a lot. My driver's license is currently 1 month expired because TSA told me, hey, do you realize this is expired? And in the state of Texas, it's going to take like a couple of months to get in for an appointment, which doesn't help either. But what you said, Terry, though, paraphrasing it back is sort of like feeling out of sync or like feeling like why I'm feeling different. And, you know, one thing I've tried to work through is like I would really start shaming myself for not paying attention, or the anxiety and everything would kick in and sort of that didn't help me pay attention any better. But I mean, I think different causes, but similar thing going on.
Yeah. And I think the thing about shame is it's a hell of a thing. And I think that you don't realize that's what it is when it's happening. I think that you just think that you're not getting something or there's something wrong with you or you feel broken in some way. But I think that you don't realize that that's what it is. You just think that you just can't do it. Like, what is wrong with me that I can't do it? And that's when it gets dangerous. Whenever you start like calling yourself an idiot in your head all the time, or you start like beating yourself up. Cause it's like, why can't I just like, I mean, I don't know how many times I locked my keys in my car whenever I was in college. It was just like a thing that I did all the time. Like in the ignition, just leave it in the car, lock the doors, leave. And then I come back later and it's like, oh, there's the keys. I guess I got to deal with that. And I would treat myself like I was like the biggest idiot in the world. Cause it's like, why can't I just take the keys out of the car? Like what is this thing that's like making me not do this really obvious thing? And I think that not knowing, like, that's why the diagnosis is important, right? Because if I do that now, I don't do that as often because my keys don't go in my car. I have a button thing that I have, which is like amazingly ADHD friendly. But like now, whenever that kind of thing happens, let's say I forget my keys in my house and I get locked myself out of my house, I don't feel like I'm an idiot. I can look back and say, well, this is a symptom of ADHD. I didn't mean to do that. It's just part of who I am. And it is frustrating. I'm going to have to be late for work today, probably. I don't like that. But it's not a problem with me. It is just who I am, and I can't feel bad about that.
Yeah. Now, you know? Yeah, and Terry, you mentioned you don't regret the delayed diagnosis, but how did you end up with that diagnosis? Was there something that prompted it? Discussion with a physician, family member said, "Hey, Terry, deal with this finally," or?
No, I feel like this story will be pretty universal to people like post-pandemic, which is I was just watching videos on YouTube and I saw a video about this concept called the wall of awful, which is like this concept where like when you can't do a thing, like let's say you want to like return email and you don't return it right away, then you keep telling yourself other reasons why you shouldn't do it. Like now they're going to think it's weird if I return the call, but I have to, and all these like other things as to why you can't do it. And it makes you just not want to do the thing, which you could just do the thing and then it's over. And like, why are you building this wall of awful? And that resonated with me because I was like, there's so many things I've done this with. Then I looked at the YouTube channel and it was called How to ADHD. And so I went to that channel and they had a video called like, Do I Have ADHD? Then she like listed all the like symptoms of it. And it was this moment of like just watching everything about me read to me on screen. It was like, wow, this is like exactly who I am. And I've never thought of ADHD in this way, right? I thought of it as like kids bouncing off the walls and not paying attention. I didn't realize that these were the symptoms of ADHD. And it was just like a mind-blowing experience and also like a weird like affirming experience where it's like, so there's an explanation for why I am the way I am. So then at that point, I sort of like tried to figure out, because I had done therapy here and there, but it's never been like a consistent part of my life. So I like called my insurance and they referred me to a like people who do diagnoses, like a clinic that specifically does that. So I did a bunch of like tests with them and they confirmed the diagnosis. They gave me a letter that said, yes, you do have ADHD. And then I started like pursuing therapy and things like that. So truly I was essentially self-diagnosed, but then I just kind of like followed it up with professionals to make sure that it was
real. You know, in my path in early 2022 was similar. I mean, I think, my mom says I was not an ADHD child. Now, again, this was the late 70s, early 80s. I don't know if it was really observed or known or diagnosed quite the same, but you know, I didn't have trouble academically. I didn't have trouble behaviorally. But then, you know, as an adult in the working world, I mean, you know, one of my earlier jobs, I ended up going to an EAP counselor. In fact, she was very insightful. I won't say what company it was, but she said, look, the problem is the company, not you. You know how many people are coming in to talk to me? And like, well, okay, well, we all have something we can work on. But I know she gave me a copy of one of the seminal books on ADHD. And I know I didn't read much of it. And so I thought that was kind of a clue in the past, but I stumbled across, in this case, it was an article, not a video. It was about, you know, basically having like an unusual sense of fairness. And I can put the exact article in there. And I was finding out like, okay, at work, this isn't just, I mean, it's often described as an ADHD tendency, but it, you know, clearly it's not only ADHD that, you know, I would get upset by unfair treatment of someone else or myself. I would have trouble letting it go. I might kind of impulsively, you know, get upset and lash out about it. Like this was not helpful professionally in some circles. And that article though, that helped me understand though, like that impulsiveness of how I reacted to things. Not that I was wrong in my reaction, but sort of like knowing like, I know I shouldn't send that email, but I did anyway.
Yeah.
But that's kind of what got me into, you know, at least potential diagnosis. And you know, you talk about therapy and there are, you know, medications for ADHD. I don't mean to pry. You can say, hey, I don't want to talk about that. But, you know, in my research, there are some experts who say, look, you know, the ADHD medications are effective, you know, with very little risk of side effect. I'm not trying to push pills on somebody who's not wanting medication. But I'm just curious in terms of treatment is specific or, you know, again, tell me to back off and you don't have to be specific. But the general question, however you'd like to answer it is, you know, how have you found treatments help you manage at least living with ADHD, working with ADHD?
Yes, I'm happy to talk about it. I think it's good to talk about because people don't talk about it, and then people feel like there's something wrong with it if they have to rely on it. So I think that that's why it's good for us to openly talk about it. So I take a antidepressant. It's the generic form of Wellbutrin, which is basically a slow-release antidepressant, because the way that executive function is like a struggle with ADHD is that your brain doesn't produce enough serotonin, and therefore, like, the serotonin is what helps you focus. So the antidepressant just sort of, like, produces more serotonin, which then allows my brain to, like, be a little bit more how other people's brains operate, right? I, at first, didn't think it did anything. Like, I was taking a small dosage, and I didn't really notice any difference in the way that I, like, thought regularly. But then I remember, it was about 2 weeks in, I was, like, laying on my bed with my dog in the middle of the day, like, playing with my dog. And I thought to myself, like, I probably should be doing something else. Like, I'm enjoying this right now, but maybe I should, like, work on something else because I have things to do. And then I thought to myself, I've never thought that before. Like, I've never thought, like, hey, priorities exist and you should maybe do those things. And that's kind of, like, the thing that I noticed is, like, it allows me to, like, still, like, I'm still the same person. It doesn't change who I am. But it allows me to, like, be a little bit more aware of my surroundings. And not just my surroundings, but like what's happening in the moment and like being a little bit more present and just conscious of what I'm doing right now and how it affects future me, you know?
And like, it was probably my mistake for not asking in advance of, hey, how specific were you willing to be about these things? Cause I wasn't trying to medication, shame anybody. I was probably just bending over backwards to awkwardly not try to force me to talk about something.
Sure.
But I mean, you know, physician had me try Ritalin, which is a different class of medication. It's hard to tell, like, for a while, I think it could have been placebo effect. I don't think they were giving me a placebo, but like, I feel like it's helping, but I don't know. And it wasn't causing any great problems for me. But you know, I'm off that medication and the journey continues. You know, because there's no blood test, there's no brain scan that tells you definitively.
Yeah. And I think that's part of it. And I also think it's something that people also don't talk about that much, which is like medication for mental health isn't always a silver bullet. Like a lot of times it's like trial and error because every brain's work a little bit differently. Everybody's lives are a little bit different, right? Like something like Ritalin, I think, wouldn't work for me because I don't need to focus at specific times, if that makes sense. Like my focus is spread out throughout the day in a pretty broad way. And I think that, I don't need to be that kind of focused that often. Whereas I think that like the slow release thing works for me because it kind of like for the 12-hour slow release, I take it in the mornings. And so I wake it up like 4 or 5. I take it around then. It lasts until around 4 or 5 that afternoon. And then I have a bit more of an open, free flowing brain after that, which is like after work. Which I think is good because then whenever I need to be creative and write books and things, then my brain is a little bit more loose and a little bit more bouncing around. And I kind of like that for creativity.
Yeah. And as much as you can generalize, I mean, you know, some people point to, you know, positive aspects of, you know, a brain that's wired a little bit differently with ADHD in terms of connecting dots. And so you might call that creativity or what have you. And so, you know, I wanted to ask you, you know, about writing. So, and you're writing and tell it to everyone first. I talked to more nonfiction authors than fiction writers. Tyranny of the Fae. This is in like the realm. This is like, described as like fantasy, not sci-fi, but
yeah.
Tell us right. a little bit about fantasy. The book first.
Yeah. So I'll take a step back so I can explain where the book came from a little bit. So I started writing a novel truly like 10 or 12 years ago. But whenever I started writing, I wrote a chapter of the book, then I wrote the second chapter, and then I rewrote the second chapter, and then I rewrote the second chapter. And I just wasn't happy with like where it was going. And I kept like rewriting the second chapter to try to figure out the direction I wanted it to go. And then I just sort of like let it go for a long time. So then about 5 years ago, whenever the diagnosis happened, I was like, well, I got to figure out something to focus on, something that I can like do consistently. So like now whenever I do anything, I try to figure out a way to tie it back to writing. That way it's like justified and also like furthering the writing career, you know? It's like whenever I do a podcast, the podcast is I interview other writers. So then they might sort of, their audience might find me and then find my writing, and it like furthers the writing career, right? So about 5 years ago, I started writing the novel, and I just wrote like a chapter a week every week is kind of like the structure. And that worked for me because it wasn't writing every day. There wasn't pressure. It was just like a consistent pattern of like writing every week. And that was kind of like how I got to it. So I wrote that novel. And then, like I said, pandemic stuff happened. I was editing the novel during quarantine, and I just didn't know what I was doing. I didn't really understand what to do. So I started writing short stories just to kind of like be creative again, to like write something original and creative. So I was writing short stories in the world of this novel, like side characters, things like that, just to kind of like do something. And that is eventually what turned into Tyranny of the Fae, is a number of those stories. I pieced together like three separate character arcs that follow three separate characters that it kind of like establishes the setting a little bit because we get to see the very origins of the world. We get to see like how the elven culture, which is like, there's a lot of like colonizer allegory stuff here. The elves are essentially the colonizers who have come into this like world with various kinds of different indigenous peoples. That are all separate allegories for different countries. I won't get into all that. We can talk about that some other time whenever the novel actually comes out. So we follow like an elven princess who comes over later, like her story is kind of like allowing us to kind of see how those two cultures like interact a little bit. And then and also like how much the elven culture has touched every other culture, because that's how colonizing works, right? Like whenever, the reason people in South America speak Spanish so broadly is because the Spanish were real busy in South America, right? that's why that's a thing. And then we follow another character who sort of like travels across the globe, so we get to kind of get a glimpse of these different countries that are allegories for different places. So it kind of like establishes the setting. So whenever the novel does come out, August of next year is the plan for that. Then this setting is kind of like already, people have a sense of what they're stepping into. It's honestly, maybe in hindsight, not the best strategy for a publishing plan, because I've released what is essentially a prequel to the novel before the novel comes out. That's not how prequels work. Prequels usually come out after the thing comes out, so that you can then go back and see the thing. So it's kind of like a supplemental material for a novel that will be out next year. But I think that it's one of those things, you know, I'm a big fan of like comic books. I read a lot of like DC Marvel stuff. And whenever they do these big event comics, they always have like these like little side comics, and you don't have to read them. But if you do, usually there's things in the main comic that you can like piece out, and it's like, oh, this is cool, and I know this thing about this character who's just here for like 2 minutes. That's kind of what this book is. Tyranny of the Fae is kind of like those things. So I think that if people read this book, they will get a lot more out of the novel. But also, like when the novel comes out, they can always go back and read this book too. It's going to always exist, right? So this is essentially it's establishing the setting for a fantasy world that I'm probably going to be living in for quite some time. So if you enjoy this interview, if you like me, like stick around. there's a lot coming up.
Well, I think it's interesting that you're reflecting, you know, on this high level process, Terry, of, you know, kind of posing the question, was it a mistake to publish the short stories first? I mean, I don't know if it's comforting. It seems like only time will tell, right?
Yeah, and the truth is, the reason I did the short stories first, because, you know, the novel existed already. I could have always, like, done editing on that and stuff. But I kind of wanted to learn the publishing process before I got to the thing I cared about. You know, like this tour, driving across the country and promoting a book, which, by the way, the book came out in August. I drove across the country June, July, August, before the book even came out. So I couldn't do signings because the book didn't exist. So like it was me visiting bookstores, giving the bookmarks. They're like, so what do you want us to do? And it's like, I don't know, sell it or something. So it was a lot of like learning things. But like now I feel like I'm at a place where I'm going to be able to more effectively release the novel whenever it comes out next year, because I do have a number of connections with bookstores now. You know, like I've met a number of bookstore owners that I like across the country that I can like reach out to and do things with. And, you know, like I know how to make a cover. I know, like, I've worked with cover artists and stuff, and I know what I like. I know how to format things. Like, all that stuff is a lot easier for me now. And I think that the novel will be able to be more effectively promoted. because all this other groundwork has been established.
So I think I made a small mistake. I think I said, was it a mistake to write the, what I should have said, was it a mistake to publish the short stories before the novel? But you know, I think it's great the way you're looking at the things you did. Some of it lays groundwork, and it, if there were any things that were mistakes, it seems like you're learning from that. That's all we can do.
Well, honestly, I think the biggest ADHD lesson is like, oftentimes you stumble onto the right answer by accident, you know, because like I published the short story book first, just because it made sense to me to not publish the thing I cared about more first. But I think that honestly, it might be a good strategy because whenever the novel comes out, if the novel is successful, because the idea is I'm going to use all these skills to push the novel harder, people that like the novel are going to want to go back and read that backstory stuff, you know? So like, it's actually going to lead, I think it will ultimately lead to more sales of these books once the novel comes out. Like I'm because I've heard a lot of indie authors say that once you get 6 books out, you're pretty set. Like those, yeah, they kind of like sell
have
themselves.
A series and sells, follow but, on sale, right? Yeah.
Right. So like, I won't have the series yet because I want the novel to be a series. The plan is for that to be a longer series, but I'm going to be releasing a number of light novels that are all like all these short stories that I wrote that year that I wrote short stories. So, cause I have a ton of them like left over. So I'm going to be releasing like 5 books over the next year. And then the novel will be the 6th book. So like once the novel comes out, I'm going to have like that breadth of stuff that people can go back and consume, which I think is actually probably like what you're supposed to do. Maybe not in this way. Again, this is like, it's maybe like, I didn't plan this. This is kind of an accident, but I think that it's actually going to be good in the long run, you know?
Well, again, our guest today is Terry Bartley. The book that's available now, the short stories collection, is Tyranny of the Fae. His podcast is Most Writers Are Fans. I encourage everyone who's a writer or a reader, I guess. Is the target audience writers or writers and readers?
So I think it's turned into an indie creative, more broadly speaking, podcast. Because I use writers very broadly. That was on purpose so that I didn't have to interview authors all the time. So I interview like musicians. I interview game designers. I interview like journalists. I interview like different kinds of writers. And I think that the main thing that we come back to a lot is like, I think that we do a lot of like we share like war stories of like being in the trenches of indie creative, like promotion. And we get to kind of like share tips and tricks we've learned along the way. And I think that probably a lot of people will find, if you're doing what we're doing, you'll find a lot of camaraderie in those conversations. So I think that that's what it really is the target audience is like people to do what we do.
I will check that out then here over the Thanksgiving weekend. That sounds like it's up my alley, Terry. So I have enjoyed talking to you. So I imagine I will enjoy listening to the conversations that you're hosting there. So maybe just one other question to finish up those going back a little bit, but you know, I think of, cause I've been in the same situation with nonfiction. There's the writing and then there's, you know, my last couple of books I've been indie publisher. I think indie publisher is a better term than self publisher because I didn't do it myself. Yeah. But is it harder for you to put a bow on the writing and the editing and the tendency to want to tweak, edit, refine forever versus, you know, is the writing, finishing the writing more difficult or is the publishing and finishing the publication and marketing work more difficult?
It's funny to think about. I mean, I think that most people, but like most authors would say that the promotion is more difficult because I think it doesn't come as naturally to most authors. I think a lot of authors are pretty introverted by nature and, you know, showing their face in videos is like challenging for a lot of people. That has never been my problem. I did theater in high school. Like, I did radio, you know, in college, I sort of thrive in this sort of like media environment. So I enjoy the promotion side of it. And I kind of think of it as like 2 separate things. And I think the publishing process, like the idea of like finishing a book and editing it, like I don't get too caught up in the editing. Honestly, editing is a thing I have to like make myself do. I was the kind of kid in high school that would like write a paper and then turn it in right away. Like, I don't want to do editing because I already did it. I don't need to go back and read it more. I've already wrote the thing. I don't need to write it more. So I kind of have to make myself edit. So like the editing that I do is kind of like things like editors suggest And I have to like hire editors to do that because I won't do it if they don't. You know what I'm saying? Like if they don't tell me where to make the edits, I probably just won't do it. So editing is like a thing that I have to like force myself to do. So the idea of like saying it's done and I don't need to go back and tweak it because it's already done. You know what I mean? Like once it's done, it's done. And like the main thing now that I'm doing because of the fact that I have all these like short story books that are coming out before the novel is like maintaining continuity, like making sure that everything matches up to the extent that makes the most sense. And then nothing contradicts itself too much. That's like the hardest thing that I'm doing right now is like, that's the challenge of having five books that comes out before your novel that's set in the same world is like, you got to make sure that it doesn't like that they all match up for your debut novel, that it doesn't have contradictions to these other weird things you released into the world for no reason. So like, that's probably the most challenging thing. But no, like I think of the writing process as like more like fulfillment for my soul, if that makes sense. Like creating is like a thing that I think I have to do as a creative person, and doing like developing these stories, creating these worlds, like telling these character stories, kind of like lets me be the person that I want to be in the world, you know? And then the promotion is just kind of like, I don't even think of it as like promoting the book, if that makes sense. I think of it as like promoting myself and promoting like creating a brand. And I've kind of been doing that my whole life in different ways because like I've had podcasts, I've had websites where I wrote like reviews and things. I've been doing interviews and stuff for a long, long time with journalism. So I sort of just think of it as like, I'm doing this thing that I've already developed a skill to do. And it's just like this fun thing that I'm doing on the side. And it's work. Like, I know it's work, like it's definitely work, but it's work that I enjoy. So, and I think that's what promotion is supposed to be. If you do promotion that you don't enjoy, then like, don't do it because you won't do it. Like, you're not going to follow it through if you make it torture for yourself. So like, I think that if you can figure out things that you enjoy to do to promote your stuff, like do that and just lean into it. So I don't think that either of them, that's a meandering answer, but I don't think that either of them are like harder for me. I don't think there's anything that I like better. I just think that they're two different like skills that I'm like flexing in different ways, if that makes sense.
Well, that's great. And thank you for sharing all of that. And thank you for answering that as Terry, as opposed to trying to speak on behalf of all ADHD people.
And honestly, I think it probably will resonate with a lot of ADHD people because of that. You know what I mean?
I think it will. So what's done is done. I think, you know, this episode is done, but I've really enjoyed it. Thank you, Terry, for sharing all that you have about your work and different jobs and ADHD and all of those reflections. I really do appreciate you sharing so openly about that. And I know that's going to help others as well.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, I think that it's, I feel like you could be the person that like allows the stigma to exist and like want to keep it a secret and like hide it. But I think the truth is like, I am who I am because I have ADHD and I don't think that I should be ashamed of that. And I think that it's good to embrace it and allow yourself to like let it be part of your identity in a good way, you know? And also like acknowledge your limitations. Like there's no problem with that. You know, I think it's good to acknowledge where you have struggles. Well,
again, thank you for sharing all of that. We've been joined today. Terry Bartley, the podcast is Most Writers Are Fans. The book, the first book of the series, Tyranny of the Fae, and the novel, the plan is later 2024. I'll put links in the show notes to all of that. Terry, again, thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Terry Bartley for being our guest today. To learn more about him, his podcast, his books, and more, again, you can look in the show notes or go to markgraben.com/mistake255. As always, I want to thank you for listening. I hope this podcast inspires you to reflect on your own mistakes, how you can learn from them or turn them into a positive. I've had listeners tell me they started being more open and honest about mistakes in their work. And they're trying to create a workplace culture where it's safe to speak up about problems, because that leads to more improvement and better business results. If you have feedback or a story to share, you can email me, myfavoritemistakepodcast@gmail.com. And again, our website is myfavoritemistakepodcast.com.